Good afternoon to everyone. Our case today is number 06-1984, In Re Emerald Casino Incorporated. Mr. Gassaway. Please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Robert R. Gassaway, Kirkland & Ellis, LLP, on behalf of Emerald Casino, Inc. Emerald was the debtor in the bankruptcy proceeding of the below and the appellate in this court. My presentation this morning, Your Honors, will emphasize 4 points. First of all, that the ruling below by Judge Weedoff in the bankruptcy court was premised on sovereign immunity grounds and was based on that, on those grounds upon reconsideration in the Emerald case. Second of all, that after the Supreme Court's decision in the Katz case, that decision can no longer be sustained. Third of all, that there are no alternative grounds in this record for affirmance. And then fourth, and importantly, in light of the fact that the appellants in their appellant's brief have already raised the issue of a remand, that this court's injunction pending appeal issued December 21, 2003 in the related Rosemont proceeding should be maintained on remand unless removed by the district court. Now, as I mentioned, Your Honors, the first point I want to emphasize is simply the grounds for the decision below. As this court is aware, Rosemont brought a separate complaint, which was immediately appealed. Emerald sought reconsideration of the dismissal below before Judge Weedoff. Judge Weedoff commended Emerald for their, quote, hard work and sharpening of focus. And after considering the issues further, he had this to say, quote, the basis for the dismissal here, and I'm reading from the supplemental appendix, page 1222, is not a finding that the provisions of this letter, meaning the August 2nd letter, are not enforceable, but rather a finding that principles of sovereign immunity and the limits of this court's jurisdiction prevent the letter from being enforced in this court.
Mr. Gassaway, I would like to jump into the second point, because my concern with your position, frankly, was that you are reading more into Katz than I at least see in it. Because if we think of what was at issue first in Hood and then what was at issue in Katz, they were both, they both dealt with who has certain property, a student loan debt, preferential transfers, and that property, of course, as we know, is something that's defined by state law. It was very easy in those cases, money. But here, we don't have something that's that simple. What we have, in fact, is your request that the state terminate its enforcement of a disciplinary proceeding. And the disciplinary proceeding itself is certainly not property. That's not what you're claiming is property. That's not what anybody else says is property. And I just don't see anything in Katz that casts doubt on the powers of states or various state entities like the Gaming Board to enforce regulatory laws, criminal laws, regulatory laws, any kind of law.
Well, let me say at the outset, Your Honor, what we have at issue here is not necessarily the termination of the disciplinary proceedings as such. Remember, our negative injunction request is limited to preserving the value of the property. It's essentially the injunction that this court issued pending appeal.
But you're assuming that this gaming license is the same kind of property that Blackacre is, or that a savings account of $10,000 is. And under state law, it's a far more limited entity. And in fact, as I see it, the proceedings that have been going on in the Illinois courts, starting with the Gaming Board's decision, now there's the appeal to the Illinois Appellate Court, are an effort to define under state law whether there actually is any property that Emerald has at this point. Because it's perfectly clear, if you look at the Riverboat Gambling Act of Illinois, that the board has the authority to revoke licenses, pretty much it says, for reasons sufficient to itself. But it says, you know, it goes on, you know, for acts in violation of the statute, anything that's a detriment to riverboat gambling, et cetera. So, you know, we don't really have property ascertained yet.
Well, we are not trying to expand our property rights in our license anywhere beyond where they were on day one of the bankruptcy.
And they were subject to revocation.
They were subject to revocation, but not to resale to the highest bidder, as they now are under 7.1.
That's all state law definition, that you don't have resale until there's revocation.
Well, that's
and if you have revocation, you don't have any interest in what happens to it thereafter.
Well, I would disagree with that, because remember, the whole impetus for a resale is to provide benefits to the state that cannot happen on simple revocation and reissuance. Remember, we were going to provide them under our settlement agreement hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, but I think you're getting ahead of the game, because it seems to me once the license is revoked, from a legal point of view, I really don't see what interest you have in it anymore.
Well, let me analogize it. Let's talk about Blackacre, and let's talk about a Board of Health, and let's talk about the sticks and the traditional bundle of property rights, where you have the right to use and the right to exclude and the right to dispose, right? Now, all we're saying is that Board of Health of Blackacre, that house, on day one of the bankruptcy, they could tape off our house, they could prevent us from using it, they could maybe prevent us from selling it without their approval, but what they could not do is what the Illinois Gaming Board is trying to do here, is actually effect a judicial sale based on powers that arose by statute after the bankruptcy proceeding.
But you haven't really, what you're saying in effect is that your license was the kind of property that would be protected by, say, the takings clauses of the Constitution, and thus you can't have it taken away from you without this kind of compensation. But I don't see anything, frankly, in the Illinois law that suggests it had that big of a bundle of rights attached to it.
Well, let me put aside the Illinois law for now, because I do think on a full remand, it's most unlikely that Judge Weedoff would find that this was not property for takings purposes or for purposes of the bankruptcy. All sides agreed that this was the sole valuable asset
of
the bankruptcy.
Sure, and look, bankruptcy law itself defines assets, for very understandable reasons, very broadly, but if the asset for police power, you know, regulatory reasons isn't there anymore, then it's not subject to being distributed in a bankruptcy plan.
Well, let me go back to your original question then and try to focus on Hood and Katz, which is where you started.
Because I'm concerned with reading Katz. As you know, and as everybody in this room knows, the Supreme Court has been very concerned with the question of state sovereign immunity. When can it be abrogated? When has it been abrogated? And Katz is a cautious step toward recognizing one Article I place where the constitutional plan abrogates, but to take the step that you're suggesting in
Katz.
Let
me push back a little bit on that, Judge Wood, because I think that, first of all, remember, both Katz and Hood took cert on an abrogation question. Did Congress have power to abrogate? And in both cases, they said, we don't have to reach that. This is all about in rem authority. Now, 2 points.
Well, they don't quite say that in Katz. I mean, in Katz, they go back to the constitutional plan in Article I and say, in fact, in a case like this one, anyway, where there is a recovery of a preference, Justice Stevens says, the question rather is whether Congress's determination that states should be amenable to such proceedings is within the scope of its power to enact laws on the subject of bankruptcies.
Correct.
They say yes.
Correct. In the very last paragraph of that opinion, what he says is that our holding today is just that without abrogation, insofar as it's treating private states the same as private parties, there's no need for an abrogation. That's falling within laws on the subject of bankruptcies. That's the whole point of the footnote of 15 that Justice Thomas's dissent induced. It's just, what is a law covering the subject of bankruptcies?
But as your opponents suggest, in all areas where the states might be similarly situated to a private creditor, perhaps the abrogation is complete, but private creditors, private parties in general, don't have regulatory power. Only the states do. And to think that the bankruptcy power can tell states, you know, that they can't take a license away from somebody allegedly, you know, affiliated with organized crime, or, you know, someone who runs a dirty establishment, or whatever the problem may be. I just don't think that that falls within this.
Well, Your Honor, that is not this case. That is not what we're trying to do. Remember, what we attached two separate agreements to our plan of confirmation. One was a private estate representative agreement, which was going to be our money handler, and the other was an earlier version of the agreement that we're trying to enforce today. And all we're saying is,
are you talking about the August 4th agreement, or the?
I'm talking about, remember, and this is critical. Here's how it worked. We attached the December 15th agreement.
The December 15th one. Okay.
Okay. Now, but remember, and this is the critical thing that Judge St. Eve overlooked in the Rosemont case. Section 1.3.8 of the plan specifically says reference to any agreement, document, or instrument in this plan means such agreement, document, or instrument as amended and modified and in effect from time to time. So Judge St. Eve said, well, you referenced the December 15th version. You didn't reference the ultimate version. Well, that's not right. We referenced the ultimate version because we referenced the December 15th version as modified. So we had two agreements that were critical. We had the money handling agreement, and we had the agreement with IGB. And all we're saying is that both of those agreements, Your Honor, are equally enforceable, both the private agreement with Mr. Katz, that we don't need to go downstate or go anyplace else and go into an Illinois court, explain to them the bankruptcy process, explain to them the importance of specific performance. That's referenced in the plan, and we have power to enforce that under Section 1142 of the Bankruptcy Code and under the specific reservations of power to enforce by motion in the bankruptcy plan. I think the other, if I may, mistake that was made below is the idea that this idea of reserving injunctive power was just loose talk. You know, just don't stop me, Your Honor, we reserve the power. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Section 6 of the plan says we reserve the power by motion to enjoin the administrative proceedings. And then we get the affirmative power, the affirmative grants, in 11.7 and 11.8. So we weren't just saying, well, don't stop us. We were saying this plan right now, without modifications, could result in an injunction by motion with this court.
But there's other language that says the IGB is free to resolve the case as it wishes. Essentially, it says something like resolution, suspension, termination. There's like a little list.
Well, I would be interested in reviewing that language. The language that was referred to below by the courts and by Judge Weedoff, who are most familiar with it, had to do with the language of sovereign immunity. And that's the final point I want to make before reserving some time for rebuttal, which is the key language, no matter where you look for it, if you look in Section 11 of the plan, if you look on the December 15th agreement, if you look at the August 2nd incarnation of the agreement, it always says waive sovereign immunity. And I would invite this court to look at the brief that we filed on May 17th, the day of the confirmation hearing, on page 12, where we're talking about the possibility of a future injunction. We move right next to the point where we say this is not barred by sovereign immunity. And one of the points we make there is it's not barred by sovereign immunity because of the in rem jurisdiction, even before the Hood decision was announced. What the IGB was saying in all of those waivers things was just, you can only enjoin us based on this specific agreement, based on these specific undertakings. This is a special appearance before the bankruptcy court. It's not a general appearance. We don't want to have a Yonkers housing situation. We don't want to have a prison takeover. We don't want to have a school board takeover. This is for this purpose and this purpose only. And there was never a doubt in our minds that so long as we could found it on a different grounds rather than express waiver, we could enforce that agreement. Thank you.
If I may, I'll hold you just for a moment. The court's conferred, and it would like to give each of the parties 10 additional minutes. Now, how you'd like to use that will be, as counsel for the appellants, will be up to you. Would you like to take some of it now, or would you prefer to hold it for rebuttal?
Let me just continue my answer to Judge Wood's question, and then I will hold it for rebuttal. I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you very much. The other point that I did want to get back to, going back to your question about Hood and Katz and what this is just two points. One is a factual point, and one is a legal point. Now, the factual point is, as Justice Thomas makes abundantly clear, and I don't think any of us are any more pro-sovereign immunity than Justice Thomas, but as Justice Thomas makes abundantly clear in his dissent, sovereign immunity concerns are at their zenith when what you're talking about is taking money out of a state treasury, as you are doing in Katz. I don't think you can look anywhere in sovereign immunity law and find any greater concern than with the act of actually taking money in a state treasury and paying out. And Justice Thomas recognizes that. The second thing that I would point out is the language that we're focusing on in the Katz decision, this concept of ancillary. That's exactly what was at issue already in Hood. Remember, the thing that really set the dissent off in Hood was the fact that they had proceeded through an ancillary process rather than by motion. So they were always focused on this question of ancillary jurisdiction. And as this court well knows from all different areas of sovereign immunity law and civil procedure, it's almost, I won't say an adage, but it's certainly a commonplace in various areas of the law that if you have jurisdiction, you have ancillary jurisdiction. If you have federal question jurisdiction, you have ancillary jurisdiction over related state law claims. In Ex parte Young, think of that as the other great exception to sovereign immunity. Well, if you proceed under Ex parte Young and you get an injunction, you have ancillary jurisdiction to get attorney's fees. You have ancillary jurisdiction to send people to order somebody to send people notices so they know that there's a benefit of the injunction. The concept of ancillary jurisdiction is not just something that the court made up out of whole cloth for this particular bankruptcy problem, but it's a concept that they made up or that they took from other contexts and applied here, specifically Judge Wood, so they could avoid the problem that you're talking about, having to take that fateful step of finding the first Article I power that allowed for abrogation. So this is well-rooted in law. If you look at the Acme Harvester case, which is cited in our brief, I invite you to look at the old bankruptcy cases from early in the century, which are basically dealing with the question of, quote, the ancillary jurisdictions of courts other than the bankruptcy court to do things like order depositions. Courts need ancillary jurisdictions. Bankruptcy court needs jurisdictions to order specific performance for exactly the reasons that appear on the face of 1142B. They need to make sure that you're not relegated to state law remedies. You don't have to prove the need for specific performance, adequate remedy at law. The bankruptcy plan was premised on the idea that we would get timely specific performance. And after Katz, it's clear that we can get that performance because it is so clearly ancillary to the bankruptcy jurisdiction. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Gassaway. We'll hear now from Mr. Huzza.
May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzzack, counsel for the defendants appellees in this matter, and I urge the court to affirm the bankruptcy court's dismissal of this action, which the district court affirmed. And the district court's discussion of the Katz case, I think, is illuminating. Judge Wood put her finger on, I think, the core issues here, which are, isn't the effect of this complaint to try to increase the debtor's property compared to what it was under state law the day that its petition was filed by nullifying pre-existing conditions on those property rights established by state law? And does Katz somehow, with respect to the alleged commitments by the gaming board in connection with the reorganization plan, does Katz somehow the state to be dragged into bankruptcy court as part of the very limited expansion of a bankruptcy court's in rem jurisdiction and ancillary authority necessary to effectuate that in rem jurisdiction.
Mr. Huzzuk, I have two questions for you, actually. One of them is that in Mr. Gasaway's favor, the court itself does not draw the line that the state is urging here in Katz. It's perhaps implicit, maybe not. I mean, but the language that the court uses is just about abrogation when you're dealing with a bankruptcy proceeding, not some bankruptcy proceedings versus others. So that's my first question. My second question is, given the fact that we have going on off in left field, as it were, the state procedures that are looking at the decision to revoke this license in the disciplinary proceeding, and I understand from the state's most recent filing that briefs will be in early August and the appellate court will proceed. Suppose at the end of the day the Illinois courts decide that it was wrong to revoke this license and that Emerald, in fact, should prevail, so the license is back on the table, if you will. How does that get plugged in appropriately to the bankruptcy proceeding, since this license actually is the only asset that anybody cares about?
Okay. With respect to the first question, you're referring to Judge Holderman's discussion of the Katz issue or bankruptcy court
Weedoff's? Well, I'm looking at Katz itself. Justice Stevens, as he's winding up his opinion, the majority opinion, phrases things quite broadly. He says, Congress may at its option either treat states in the same way as other creditors insofar as concerns laws on the subject of bankruptcies or exempt them. Its power to do so arises from the bankruptcy clause. And, you know, in the context of what he's just written, he's basically saying Congress decided to bring the states in. So where do we find the line in Katz, anyway, that the state is urging us to adopt, saying, well, that's when the states are acting as creditors or when the states are acting as holders of preferential transfers or whatever, where do we find this regulatory line that you're urging?
I think we find the line implicit in the entire background for that case, in the Hood case, in which the only relationships between the debtors and the states involved commercial traditional debtor-creditor type relationships, a fight over money as to whether the state was overpaid or underpaid, where it was wearing its hat as a typical creditor and tried to play the trump card of sovereign immunity to get an advantage over other creditors. And that quote that you gave from Justice Stevens' opinion, indicating that Congress has the authority to treat the states like other creditors, I think it makes it implicit that the assumption there was bankruptcy deals with that type of adjustment of debtor-creditor relations in that context, and by and large leaves intact, preserves, respects, and validates the entirely separate sphere of state governmental functions where it's wearing its hat not as a creditor but essentially as a regulator wearing its police power functions. I think if you compare, using the analogy that Mr. Gasaway offered, which is that this is really should be treated like a like Blackacre, where the Board of Health can board it up and tape it off and tell people that they can't go in there, is, I think, a misleading analogy. What we have here is a license. It's not a fee simple interest in real estate, and the court's reference to a takings clause jurisprudence is relevant because the takings clause cases indicate that when the state issues a license subject to conditions and those conditions fail, the property interest is fully recognized by a determination that the licensee has no property. Perhaps a better analogy would be if the state owned real estate, leased it to a private party with a clause allowing an option to buy or articles for deed provision, and that right failed before the lessee filed bankruptcy, and then before the state could essentially enforce its right to retain title of its property, then they'd say, ha-ha, bankruptcy court trumps state ownership interests here. We now get to take the property free and clear regardless of what state law may have said. And that's even in a traditional debtor-creditor situation. When you get to the stronger sovereign immunity interests of the state in a police power function, I think the background of the Hood and Katz cases and the line that we draw is even more paramount.
Could I pause for a moment? Another branch, as I understand, of Emerald's argument is that this isn't really police power anyway. This is really the state just wanting all of the proceeds of the license for itself, not a police power issue. As I said, it kind of reminded me of a takings argument, in effect. But what's your response to that?
We've been there, done that. They lost. It's over with. They had a trial on that issue.
2003.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The bankruptcy court concluded that even though the statute had been amended in the course of this disciplinary proceeding to revoke the license so that the state, upon reissuing its license, in which Emerald no longer had any property interest whatsoever, instead of reissuing it for a nominal fee, would be able to auction it off like they auction the airwaves these days. In the old days, they auctioned airwaves for nothing. And they still belong to the government. They're periodic licenses that are subject to the conditions of the government's retained ownership interest. In this case, that's what happened in the middle of that proceeding. The statute was passed. It made a lot of sense. And the bankruptcy court concluded after a full trial on the merits, where Judge Weedoff said the merits are dispositive here, this is an exercise of regulatory police power. This is not an attempt by the state to advance its pecuniary interests. That was appealed to Judge Holderman, the same district court judge whose decision is under review here. He affirmed and said this was a regulatory proceeding from the outset. It's still a regulatory proceeding. Nothing has changed in that regard. And they brought an appeal of that decision, which was voluntarily dismissed with prejudice. Judge Weedoff in this case said, we've got collateral estoppel here, citing this court's Miller brewing case, the light beer case.
I would say law of the case, probably.
Sure, collateral estoppel, I think, is the principle he invoked. But the idea was that it was ripe enough, it was final enough, it was decided. And even if the court found reason not to apply preclusion principles here, I think the same facts warrant the same conclusion, which is that simply because the state would obtain money from the reissuance of a license in which the licensee's interests have been extinguished pursuant to pre-existing state law doesn't mean that the state is no longer wearing its regulatory police power hat. And ultimately, if that's the case, remember that what's going on here is they claim they're only trying to prevent an expropriation of their license and the state taking the proceeds of their license instead of Emerald being able to dispose of those proceeds through the bankruptcy process. The relief that they're asking for isn't just to control who gets the proceeds. The relief they're asking for is to prevent the revocation of the license, because if it's not revoked, then they retain an ownership interest. And I think that leads to your second question, which is, what would be the effect of a state court decision reversing the revocation order? And it raises a sort of a host of different potential possibilities, and it's hard to predict which one may ensue. But if the decision were simply that there were a procedural irregularity and that the gaming board had to start a revocation procedure over again, like a retrial in a criminal case where there was a non-harmless error, then the revocation might begin up again. If, in fact,
I was just trying to imagine sort of at the end of the day, the state loses this and the revocation based on that period of those grounds, as it were, doesn't stand. I guess I was trying to figure out, is there any way that asset will be disposed of through the bankruptcy reorganization plan? Does it just sort of plug back into the plan at that point?
Well, remember that the alleged, I'd like to clarify that the alleged commitments of the gaming board, subject to all sorts of qualifications as to whether they were binding under state law in the first place, whether the gaming board had authority to do what it was purporting to do without the approval of the Attorney General, which was an independent party to that agreement and had state constitutional powers to prevent compromise of litigation of this variety. But in that scenario, we're still back to the issue of whether those commitments would be enforceable. And it's the state's position that that is a state law claim. It is not one that would fall within the Ex parte Young principle by any means. The bankruptcy court's opinion, which is entitled to strong deference, and Emerald has made no real convincing showing that that deference should be set aside here. The determination was that these agreements were not part of the plan. Emerald specifically made those representations.
I got the implication of what you said, that the Attorney General was totally unaware of the position of the Gaming Board during the time of the negotiation for the contract in question. Is that correct?
No. If I created that implication, I did not intend to. No, the Attorney General and the Gaming Board were, for a while, both essentially side-by-side co-pilots,
right,
trying to see if there were some workable compromise here, and they were co-signatories.
So that the suggestion that the board didn't have authority unless they consulted with the Attorney General is just a throwaway line?
No. After the failure of the conditions of the first side letter, which was attached to, but let me reemphasize, not incorporated in the plan, after the failure of those conditions, the Gaming Board then divided in interest for a period of several months from that of the Attorney General. And that implicates...
So that's when the August 4 letter is written. At that point, the Attorney General is not on board?
Absolutely not. And that was at the tail end of the period when there was this frolic, if I may say, by the Gaming Board with respect to their position regarding what was the appropriate resolution of the disciplinary proceeding on a settled compromise basis, as opposed to, in their ultimate judicial capacity, if it were fully tried before them. And they put in disclaimers in that second side letter that they warranted that they had no authority to enter into it, which was true both as a matter of contract law, because the first side letter made clear that the Attorney General had an independent power to reinstate the revocation proceeding regardless of what the Gaming Board's position was. And the Attorney General made it clear approximately a week before the confirmation hearing that she intended this revocation proceeding to go forward. Her attitude was, let's try the case and see whether revocation is warranted based on the evidence. That evidence is now in. And so the prayer in this complaint to halt the revocation proceeding not only implicates extraordinary sovereign immunity concerns like those in Younger and other cases where you're trying to stop a revocation proceeding, now they're trying to undo a completed revocation proceeding in bankruptcy court when that's being fully addressed and considered by the state appellate court on administrative review.
Yeah, it's interesting language in that August letter where the Gaming Board, after saying all the other things it says that it makes no warranties or representations regarding its power or authority to do anything, basically, to take any action described.
It's because I think Illinois law is so fundamentally clear, and even more recently in the Lyons versus Ryan case and the Scicchiti case, which we allude to in our briefs, the Supreme Court has reinforced the alternative or the second holding of the Gus Newberg case, which is that as a matter of state constitutional common law, the Attorney General trumps all other state agencies when it comes to settling a civil litigation matter, including an administrative matter. So the Gaming Board, aware of that law, put in those disclaimers. I think it's important to emphasize Judge Weedoff's interpretation of the plan, because under the Heartland Steel case, that's entitled to substantial deference, and that's a path through which they make many of their arguments that the state has somehow waived its sovereign immunity here. Ultimately, he didn't just say that you can pursue these claims in state court. He also said that the very language that they rely on in the plan as a basis for arguing that the state has somehow waived its sovereign immunity holds the opposite, that there was no waiver of sovereign immunity. That interpretation, too, through which their waiver claim must run, is likewise entitled to substantial deference.
Could I ask you, though, what is really left of this plan? Judge Weedoff seems to be quite aware that there's this giant contingency off on the corner about whether the license will be revoked. You reproduced in your brief on page 14 some of the exchange where he actually anticipates. He says, so if the membership of the Gaming Board changed, there would still be a potential for revocation. And at that point, Emerald's lawyer says, well, lots of things can happen. But Judge Weedoff seems to know that here's this Chapter 11 plan, and it might actually be something that can operate on real assets, but it might be something that operates on functionally nothing. Is there any problem with reading it that way?
No. I think that the plan contains a contingency. The suggestion in the plaintiff's papers that the plan required that the license be resold is inaccurate. The plan anticipates that if this contingency fails, that the plan would essentially collapse, not be successfully consummated in bankruptcy terminology, and that they would go back to square one. There's no obligation in the plan that this sale occur. There is the anticipation that if the license is not revoked and the gaming board acts in conformity with what a then majority of its members believed was the right policy approach at the time, that there could be an auction of Emerald's business and its interest in the license. But that's merely a contingency. The court's plan clearly anticipated the opposite. And I think that plays into an issue that I think is intriguing, although Emerald appears to have waived it, and we have taken that position in our brief, which is totally apart from their position that bankruptcy in rem jurisdiction per se nullifies state police powers, which I think is basically a non-starter, regardless of the fact that we're not dealing with trying to get money out of the state here. We're going even deeper. We're taking away the tools of enforcement of state law. So if there were an issue with respect to Katz's application to these allegedly consensual commitments to permit effectuation of the bankruptcy plan, we are now so far afield from the nature of traditional ancillary jurisdiction to effectuate in rem jurisdiction that it's hardly imaginable. We have what would be a post-petition state law contract entered into with a state specifically excluded from a bankruptcy plan that would at most fulfill a contingency in a plan of reorganization. And the plaintiff is essentially, or the argument they didn't make, would be that itself falls within the in rem jurisdiction and narrow expansion of that in rem jurisdiction created by Katz. Boy, that's a stretch. And I want to offer this. Historically, in rem jurisdiction has been the adjudication of rights in property against the world. And we know the admiralty cases. We know the mortgage foreclosure cases. There's a small list that are paradigmatic of that type of situation. And historically, the ancillary relief authority involves situations in which there was a first to take jurisdiction and possession of property subject to an in rem claim situation, where if there was state and a federal court, that the first to take possession of the res had the ability to exclude jurisdiction by any other a sovereign, as well as individual private parties that might interfere with their adjudication of the rights in that res. And, of course, bankruptcy courts have a special place in the law because even if a state court may have prior in rem jurisdiction over property, bankruptcy court jurisdiction is nascent nationwide, and because of the unique interest there, it trumps that state jurisdiction. But the notion of ancillary in rem powers is still the same. And that's essentially what this court did when it entered a temporary stay with respect to the potential reissuance of the license. A bankruptcy court has the power to determine its own jurisdiction, of course, but it doesn't have the power to expand the property subject to that jurisdiction under the rubric of deciding what its jurisdiction is. And so if there was a temporary dispute over what the property interest was, and a bankruptcy court said, well, before this property disappears from my ability to distribute it among creditors, if in fact it belongs to the debtor, I'm going to stop things temporarily among other parties and other jurisdictions. That's not what's going on here. What's going on here is an effort by the plaintiff in this case to order a permanent halt to a state regulatory enforcement action. That's not just a standstill order so that the scope of the property interest can be determined. This is a Alexander the Great's knife cutting through the Gordian knot and deciding that we'll just take all the pieces here for ourselves. And I think that distinction is important. The idea that anything that could be called related to bankruptcy somehow fits within this ancillary power to effectuate bankruptcy court's in rem jurisdiction is not, I think, one that can be sustained, especially given the important notions of sovereign immunity that are implicated in this case. I noticed that there was the one comment by Mr. Gassaway at the beginning that if, in fact, there were a remand, he would ask that this court extend its stay in the companion bankruptcy case until it would be vacated by the lower court. And I don't think that a remand is appropriate, but if that's the position the court takes, that should be an issue to be decided by the lower court in the first instance, whether a motion for a preliminary injunction that they haven't yet filed should be granted based upon the traditional showings that would be relevant to that type of relief. So I urge the court to reject the aggressive and unwarranted expansion of the Katz decision that the plaintiffs are seeking here, to uphold the bankruptcy court's interpretation of the plan, insofar as it both rejects the claims that the plan itself obliges the gaming board to do anything or incorporates any of these alleged commitments, and it's finding, in addition, that the critical portions of the plan refute, do not support the plaintiff's claim that the state has somehow agreed to set aside its sovereign immunity by taking actions expressly outside the bankruptcy context. If I may just jump back quickly to the discussion of what effect Katz would have with respect to alleged consensual agreements by states, it seems to me that Katz really adds nothing to the traditional analysis of waiver of sovereign immunity principles. A state has an election, and it has an election if it's otherwise not a creditor or doesn't submit a proof of claim to not participate in a bankruptcy plan or voluntarily to deal with a debtor. If it decides voluntarily to deal with the debtor, it can choose then, as the Toy King lender did in the case relied upon by Emerald, to insist that its voluntary commitments be a part of the plan. In that case, you have a waiver of sovereign immunity, and Katz doesn't add anything to the equation. If, on the other hand, the state consciously chooses, as in this case, not to be a part of the bankruptcy, to exclude itself from the bankruptcy process entirely, to engage in separate negotiations or dealings on a post-petition basis with respect to possibly enforceable state law agreements with the debtor, then having left itself outside and so far outside the core aspects of the in rem nature of the bankruptcy case in the first place, then Katz can't possibly reach that far. So you have a dovetailing or a lining up of the interests that might arguably extend under Katz to a displacement of sovereign immunity for police powers. Either the state agrees to be bound by a plan, which is not the case here, and submit itself to the bankruptcy court's jurisdiction voluntarily under waiver principles, and perhaps likewise under Katz, or it doesn't, in which case Katz wouldn't apply. So I urge the court in this case to affirm the lower court's judgment, and unless you have any other questions, thank you.
Apparently not. Thank you.
You again for this opportunity to emphasize several points. First of all, the whole premise of our argument is that we're seeking to implement the regulatory power, not to undermine it. Remember,
how can you say that when what the state wants to do is have the disciplinary proceeding, which is something the board has and appeals go to the Illinois courts?
Your Honor, recall that our position, and I think this will be borne out on remand after the sovereign immunity issue is put aside, is that there was an exercise of regulatory power that was embodied in the official resolution of the board on July 28th. It was reaffirmed on a second resolution on August 2nd.
But those are questions of state law, and ultimately what the gaming board did, whether it should have or not, being the issue, I assume, one of the issues before the Illinois Appellate Court. But eventually the board decides that the license should be revoked in a disciplinary proceeding. And I guess I still have trouble imagining how the existence of a bankruptcy off in the side somehow exempts an entity, any entity, Company A, from the regulatory powers of the state.
Well, Your Honor, the premise of our whole argument with respect to the letter is that that was a valid exercise of the regulatory powers of the state. Now, I heard Mr. Huzaw to say it was ultra vires, you had to have the Attorney General on board. But remember...
But you're asking us to decide a question of state law in the course of deciding whether this was a regulatory... See, there's a characterization question first, regulatory or not, which we've discussed. And then there's a question of, well, if it was a regulatory matter, which was the operative act? And Illinois law surely determines that, right?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. That would be determined according to Illinois law.
But Illinois has a procedure. It's happening right now, and you're asking the federal court to interfere?
No. If I may, Your Honor, let me say that the daily diet of the bankruptcy court is to decide state law issues. If you look at many of the cases
that we cite. But they're
routine
state law issues. They aren't questions of this nature. They're not regulatory issues. The bankruptcy court doesn't arrogate to itself the police powers of the state.
No.
They figure out who owns the land. Did you have a contract? Is it enforceable? Did you transfer the property? Was there fraud? You know, what have you?
A mind-numbingly various list of important state law determinations. And in the cases that we cite in our brief, it's everything from chattel mortgages to Wisconsin to Michigan product liability.
Sure.
This case is answered by the Gardner versus New Jersey case.
What about Nelson versus La Crosse County District, our court's case from 2002, where... There's a criminal action that this person tries to enjoin.
Well, that of course was premised on a view of sovereign immunity that was has now been superseded by Katz. I think.
So you think that I'll just say that folds back into your Katz argument.
Then. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. That was completely vitiated by Katz. But the point I want to make is you have to assert for purposes of this decision that this is a valid exercise of Illinois regulatory authority. And I understand your point, Judge Wood, that state law issues may be the daily diet of the bankruptcy court. But consider the ultra vires problem that the Supreme Court faced in Gardner versus New Jersey. The question there was whether or not a state official high ranking in New Jersey, the controller, properly submitted a particular issue to the bankruptcy court. Now, what did the United States Supreme Court do? Well, it said, let's look to New Jersey law. Let's see if it's ultra vires. So it is true that there was this warranty that they were not warranting that they didn't need the Illinois AG on board. But under fundamental bankruptcy law principles, that's a state law determination, maybe a more important one than chattel mortgages and product liability law, but that's fundamentally a state law determination for the bankruptcy court, and it's no different than examining the authority of the controller in the Gardner case. Now, the second point I'd like to emphasize is Mr. Huzaw would make this aggressive reading of Katz. Remember, Katz involved taking money out of the state treasury. This just involves an ancillary order in order to effectuate jurisdiction. And I can't emphasize it enough. Bankruptcy court jurisdiction requires specific performance of contracts. We're not asking for any type of performance against the state that we're not also going to be asking against Mr. Katz if all of a sudden Mr. Katz reads his estate representative agreement to give all residual monies to him rather than the state. So this is not nearly as aggressive as Katz itself. And then I'd like, Judge Wood, if I could, just to take a swing at a couple of questions you asked. Is this money going to be plugged back into the bankruptcy? In our view, absolutely not. We see no indication that if they take the license and run with it, they're ever going to put money back into the bankruptcy court. We see innocent creditors and innocent shareholders being completely wiped out.
Okay, so just to be clear, I was trying to hypothesize that you win in this Illinois appellate court proceeding that I guess your brief is now due August the 4th or whenever it's due. And, you know, you prevail based on whatever grounds you might prevail. And so now you have the license again. It hasn't been revoked. You know, its status is restored. And my thought was, well, now it's there. And what would prevent it from plugging back into the bankruptcy at that point?
Okay. If they do not take it and sell it and have it go away, then, of course, the assets would be there, and certainly we are contesting that. But remember, the whole premise...
So you would agree that if you actually prevail and all the right stays are in place, nobody's resold it, nobody's done anything, you win in the Illinois appellate court, it goes back into the Chapter 11 plan?
Absolutely. Okay. If we win, it's going to go back into the Chapter 11 plan. But remember, the whole issue, and this is critical again, the whole issue that prompted that brief that we filed on the day of the proceeding had to do with this abstruse bankruptcy law concept called feasibility. And the idea of feasibility is the plan contains, you know, has a self-contained set of powers and conditions that allow it to be feasible in and of itself. And the way our plan was structured is that the Illinois Gaming Board could opt in, stage number one. We presented testimony from three members that would give a strong inference that they would opt in. Stage number two, they act voluntarily as long as they comply with their commitments. We believe in comity. We don't believe in injunctions for no reason. But stage number three, we expressly reserve the rights in case they break their commitments instead of implementing the regulatory powers they promised. If they break those commitments, yes, indeed, we could seek an injunction under 11.7 or 11.8. And so that's how the plan was structured. I just, before, as I sit down, would emphasize a couple of throwaway points, though, but that are most important here. Mr. Huzzah said Judge Holderman's discussion of Katz is illuminating. Now, that may be a throwaway, but the fact is just Judge Holderman did not analyze this case through the lens of ancillary jurisdiction. He did not even use the word ancillary. So, in effect, this court is the first court to apply Katz to the facts of this case.
Mr. Casaway, I think we'll have to end it there.
Well, you've been very generous, Your Honor. I truly appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, the court thanks both counsel for extraordinarily fine oral arguments today and certainly for extraordinarily fine submissions on the brief as well. And the case will be taken under advisement.